Intelligent Design Part 1 was presented by Charlie Dewberry on February 20th, 2007 at McKinsey Study Center's Tuesday night class. The copyright for this recording is held by Gutenberg College, Inc., 2007. Gutenberg College is a nonprofit organization, and contributions may be made at www.gutenberg.edu. This material may be copied and distributed in whole for non-commercial and educational purposes, subject to the inclusion of this introduction. All other rights reserved.
Okay, well, we'll get started. I'm Charlie Dewberry. I'm on staff here. I'm a tutor at Gutenberg College. And the question tonight of intelligent design, questions with regard to evolution, creation, or intelligent design, they've been on my plate for a long time. My background is in biology. I grew up in the Midwest and actually came out to Oregon in the late 70s to pursue a PhD in stream ecology. And I've spent the last 30 years working in the field. I mostly dive and count salmon. I've been able to work in places from San Francisco all the way around into the Kamchatka Peninsula in Siberia. So I've just been very fortunate to be able to work in the field of biology. But certain questions about biology have plagued me for a long time, and part of what I'm going to talk about is my 30-year-plus struggle with science, biology, how to make sense out of theories, how to dialogue with people about these issues, and it's not been easy. For the most part, I've tried as hard as I can to avoid them, because it seems to me that there really isn't any intelligent discourse with regard to these kind of issues. What we find is two sides that want to annihilate their opponent. That it isn't really about what's true, or at least what we know and don't know at this point. It simply is, let's win. And as I say, I've just avoided it for it as much as I could. But two events in the last couple years changed that. One was a book by a guy named Michael Ruse. He's a philosopher of science, and he's really probably the original philosopher of biology. So he's been at it a long time, and he's a showman, very charismatic. And he's been one of the leading Darwinian bulldogs of the last 25 or 30 years. Very articulate. And he wrote a book, which actually what he pointed out was it looked to him like the problem, why this issue doesn't go away. It's a matter of history, and it's about ideas. And, well, we all know that Darwin's right, but there really is a problem, and that is a lot of the Darwinians have basically been arguing on a platform of religion, not science, so that he was arguing that the Darwinians were actually championing a religious perspective, and he was pointing at people like Dawkins and others who are very outspoken opponents of religion and anyone who denies that Darwin's theory is true. And he pointed out that, well, actually, you know, they were going way past science, and the real problem is not about science, it's about religion. And so that the real strong reaction against Darwinian evolution is not about science, it's a strong reaction about religion. Well, I found that interesting that someone would point out that there may be religious issues on the side of the Darwinians. And the second one was the Dover court case. with regard to intelligent design. I don't want to say anything more about it. I'll talk about it maybe near the end tonight. If not, that will be the start probably of next week. We'll see where it breaks out. But I'll just say that I was so appalled at the judge's ruling that I just had to respond to it. Anyway, I'll talk about that when I get there. But those two things really resulted in me putting my ideas together in a book that we published last summer. So as I said, these ideas have interested me for a long time. My background was biology. I came out to Oregon in the late 1970s to get a PhD in stream ecology. On my way out here, I don't know why, I picked up two books. And those two books, some would say they radically altered my life. Some would say they destroyed my career. Others would say they've actually made a career. So I'm not sure which. But the two books were Thomas Kuhn's The Structure of Scientific Revolutions and Michael Polanyi's Personal Knowledge. Both those two books destroyed everything I'd been taught from grade school about what science was and how you did it. And here I was, a PhD student in science, and I was clearly convinced I had no idea what science was. I spent 3 or 4 years at Oregon State wrestling with these questions. During that period of time, I came to the conclusion that Darwin's theory was actually not a very good philosophical argument, that the central argument in Darwin's theory was actually fallacious, incomplete at best, and probably fallacious. So at that point, I began to try to put my ideas together about what science was and how to do it. And you might suspect that I was beginning to run into a lot of problems working in the scientific community. And a year or so later, in part the result of interacting with some of the staff members here, Jack Crabtree and Ron Julian, that I actually became a Christian. So I spent about half my life, about 30 years, as an atheist or an agnostic, committed that Darwin's theory was true. And approximately the other half of my life I've spent as a theist, believing that Darwin's theory's not right, but not... I haven't been able to finish my own theory at this point of what I think it looks like, although I think I've made some progress on that. So anyway, what I'm really going to talk about is my 30-year struggle with this stuff. And so what I'm going to do tonight is I'll start out and I'll talk a little bit about intelligent design. What is it? And how does it basically fit within the longer evolution creation debate? And then I want to back up and just give a very brief sort of history of some of the important ideas in biology from Aristotle to the present. Very brief. Just so that we have an idea of where this fits in the long-term debate about biology. And then I'll talk about the specifics of intelligent design, and then the interaction between the scientific community and the proponents of intelligent design. And then I'll wrap up with my critique of the court case, if I get there tonight. We'll see if I get there. So what I'd like to do is I'd like to take it in sort of sections, and if I could lay out a section, and then if there's any questions about clarifying any of that or anything you want to talk about the section, then let's just take those and then do a couple sections, and then I'll leave a fair amount of time at the end just to throw it open for more general questions. So does that make sense? Okay. Well, first, what is intelligent design? What is it claiming? And how is it related to Darwin's theory? Well, first, basically, intelligent design is a theory that that's built on two different ideas. The idea of intelligent design as the modern concept arose in about 1980. Now, it's related closely to a longer standing argument that's been, well, an argument that was essentially made at the time Darwin was alive, and you can trace it back further, all the way back to the Greeks. There's actually a pre-Socratic version of an intelligent design perspective. So it has a very long history, but intelligent design, as we understand it, there's really two major proponents of the theory. One of them is Michael Behe, who is a biochemist. He wrote the book Darwin's Black Box. He was here a number of years ago, so we got to spend some time with him. And the place he came to was, it seemed to him, working in microbiology and biochemistry, that there were these, what he called, irreducibly complex systems. And by that, what he meant was that you have, he calls it a system, but the analogy he uses is, think of a mousetrap. And a mousetrap has a number of moving parts. And all those moving parts have to be present. All those moving parts have to be made in such a way that they can perform their function. All of them have to be there. All of them have to be able to interact with all of the other parts before this thing works at all. So his point was, is that, well, if you're going to be a Darwinian, how can there be any selection on this thing? How can there be any selection or natural selection on this thing until it works? I mean, because if it isn't working, if it's just sitting there, then all these parts are just randomly moving around. And his point was, you're never going to get a complex thing like a mousetrap. You can't just, by chance, you'll never, you know, it's just, what are the chances of getting all the parts together that exactly fit together, that is something as simple as a mousetrap? How can you ever get all of that together all at one time so it works? And his point was, is that there's no mechanism within a Darwinian framework to account for how you can get any selection on that thing to make it fine-tuned to accomplish this purpose. So it seemed to him that there were a number of, as he looked at biology, there were a number of biological things that he pointed at. Things like cilia, the tails on microscopic organisms, or flagellum. Again, tails on bacteria and small things. Another one he pointed at was the clotting process of blood. If all those pieces aren't there and exactly the right, if all those molecular building blocks, all the proteins and the structures aren't there so that it fits together, like our mousetrap model, clotting won't work. He also pointed at the immune system, that, again, there's a large number of very fine-tuned parts that have to fit together, and if any one of them is missing, it doesn't work at all. And again, how can you account with a Darwinian sort of explanation for that? So it seemed to him that that pointed to the idea that there was an intelligent designer. Now, as far as his articulation of his theory, he pointed out that he wasn't saying anything in particular about this designer other than it was intelligent. I mean, the fact that it was quickly pointed out to him that he's in fact a Catholic, so he probably had a pretty good idea of what he had in mind. But as he articulated the theory, his theory was, well, I don't know about that, but at least what I know in microbiology and biochemistry, it looks like it's intelligently designed. The other major modern proponent of intelligent design is a guy named William Dembski. And his background is in, he has a PhD in math, a PhD in philosophy, and a master's degree in divinity. And he's cranked out an incredible number of books already. I don't know how he's doing this, but he's just cranking stuff out. And basically, his perspective is he takes more of an abstract, intellectual, theoretical approach to this question. So the kinds of things that interest him are, can we recognize, how would we recognize something in nature that's intelligent? And what he has in mind is something like, I mean, I'm sure we've all seen these where you'll be driving along and let's see, Mapleton has one or Garibaldi's a good example. You'll be driving into Garibaldi and there's this big white group of rocks that are in the shape of a G up on the mountainside. Now, the point is that could just be a random assortment of rocks that just happened to be in that sort of position. Yet every human being on the planet will drive by and go, oh, geez, somebody made that for Garibaldi. I mean, how do we know that? How does an anthropologist or an archaeologist pick something up and call it an artifact, something built by an intelligent agent? How do they know it wasn't just the product of random chance? It's those kind of questions that interest Dembski. Now, he isn't interested in the psychology or the cognitive way we figure that out, but what he's interested in is the mathematical description of that. So that's kind of his angle on this stuff. And so what he's pointed out is that he's looking for what he calls specified complexity. So, for example, we can have, you know, a random 13-letter combination on the board that makes no sense. There may not be any vowels in it. And it's complex, but he would say it's unspecified. I mean, no one associates any kind of communication with that. But even if they're all put together, if you have a, I don't know if it's 13 letters, but he uses the first line of Moby Dick, call me Ishmael. And he says everyone would look at that and know that that was specified, it's complex, and it was obviously designed by someone. That isn't a random bunch of letters. Now, could it be? Well, it sort of could be, but we really make a distinction between what's specified and unspecified according to Dembski. Now, there's a lot of complex issues in that, but that's the sort of approach he's taken towards this issue of intelligent design. And basically, they're the two major proponents of intelligent design now. And as most of you probably are aware, there's an institute in Seattle, the Discovery Institute, that has largely been sort of the finance and organization behind the intelligent design movement. And there's a number of people, they've connected a lot of the people interested in intelligent design, including both Behe and Dembski. And so they sort of coordinate and work on out of the Discovery Institute. Okay. I'll stop for a few minutes and just say, with regard to intelligent design, just as a theory, or the people involved in it, any specific questions about that at this point? Yes.
When you were talking about the second one,
Dembski?
Mm-hmm. What came to mind is in nature, like I think in the desert, there's one bird that has a particular curved beak that's only good for a particular cactus flower.
Oh, uh-huh.
Yeah, is this something that he would consider?
No. As I say, Dembski is mostly a mathematician. He's thinking abstractly about this thing. He's not looking at any specific sort of organisms.
Oh, okay.
So yeah, he's doing the abstract theoretical parts of this primarily. I'm not aware that he's ever worked with any particular organisms.
So, but why I was thinking about that,
mm-hmm,
is because I've read the evolutionary argument for that, and it just sounds so ridiculous that this cactus could develop in a certain way, and the bird,
mm-hmm,
could develop in a certain way at the same time. I mean, if you're using evolution, the cactus would die out from not being able to produce, or the,
mm-hmm,
bird would die out from not being able to eat.
Potentially. We'll talk about that more probably next week. But one thing I would like to highlight here, it's not that either Behe or Dembski or most of the proponents of the intelligent design movement that I've heard speak or see written, it's not that they're denying that there isn't Darwinian evolution in nature. It's just they're saying it can't account for everything. So, for instance, Behe is more than willing to agree that very much of what we see in biology and what we see in nature is the result of Darwinian evolution. So, on one hand, he's, you know, his position is not everything, you know, that the evidence is not that everything suggests that it's intelligent design. He's just saying that with regard to these particular structures that have irreducible complexity. And the same with Dembski. He's not denying that there's any evolution. But what he's saying, but he's highlighting for him the idea that at least portions of it or certain aspects of it look like there's intelligence to it. Yes?
Just a question. If intelligent design implies an intelligent designer,
mm-hmm,
then when you're confronted with a non-intelligent or badly designed biological entity,
uh-huh,
what conclusions, you draw the same conclusions, well, that would be an unintelligent designer or a bad designer?
Well, or the option is there's no designer.
Or no designer?
Yeah. Well, and ultimately, that's actually getting ahead to the next section. But one of the things I find interesting here is before Darwin, there wasn't any human being that would deny that it looked intelligent. I mean, that wasn't even an issue. And Darwin himself, we'll see, his argument was not that. I put it backwards, so I got to be careful how I say it. Let me turn it around and say it positively so I get it right. Is he wasn't arguing that nature doesn't look designed. He was arguing that he could explain why it looked designed by chance and selection. So what's interesting to me to start with, all the biologists prior to Darwin and everybody else thought it looked designed, and Darwin thought it looked designed. He was giving an account for why with natural processes he could account for that. So anyway, I find it quite interesting that now we get to the point where nobody seems to be able to see design any longer. Or for the most part, people are unable to see design in nature. Something's really shifted here. So anyway, it's just that's an interesting observation and a good question with regard to this. But yeah.
Was there something like that puts in a nutshell what Darwin said?
Yeah, actually, that's what I'm going to talk about next. So that might be a good segue into that. Yeah?
I wanted to ask you about someone before Darwin. You don't talk about any of those before Darwin? Because there's one man that I'm really interested in.
Who's that? Oh. Well, I wasn't planning on saying much about him, but I'll say just a little. Okay? All right, well, let me back up and give a brief history of some of the basic biological issues here. The first thing I want to make a couple comments about is classification. So, I mean, this plays a central role in this debate. Biology really starts with Aristotle. Aristotle is fundamentally a biologist, and his philosophy is not understandable if you don't realize that. In part, Aristotle's philosophy is aimed at refuting the atomists, democritus of his day. So if you want to see a refutation of a materialist atomist, there's one been around for a very long time. Many would say that was the foundation of the start of biology, was Aristotle's response to the atomists. But what I want to talk about first is the idea of classification. And this starts with Aristotle, the idea of a genus and species. Now, a genus for Aristotle is... it's a class where all members have the same essential features. They look the same. So, for example, animals. All animals have the same set of features. Every example in that class is just as much animal as any other animal in it. They're all equally animal. That's called a kind. Now, according to Aristotle, there were these genera, these kinds, that differed by being substantially different. So, for example, you might have birds and fish. Well, those are two kinds, meaning every example of a fish is just as much a fish as any other example in that class is a fish. And every bird the same way. But there's a gulf between them. And according to Aristotle, that's unbridgeable, because they're qualitatively different. Now, a species, then, is a classification that talks about what are the differences of degree within this class. So, for example, we could take birds, and we might have ducks, geese, warblers. Well, they're all birds, but they differ by degree from each other. Some of them are bigger, some of them are smaller, some of them have bigger wings, bigger beaks, that sort of thing. But they just differ by degree. So in his classification system, he recognized that there were two classes of things. One was these classes that are kinds. And then underneath that, you had differences of degree. Now, in Aristotle's picture of a genus species, it isn't set as it is today. So when we think of genus species, we think of it in a classification scheme that was designed by Linnaeus. Kingdom, phylum, class, order, family, genus, species. Well, genus species tells us what that organism is. Well, that's not how Aristotle used it. Sometimes he would say, in the class animal, we now have birds, fish. In the genera ducks, we have mallards, pintails, whatever. So from Aristotle's perspective, genus species just referred to what we were trying to organize for whatever purpose we're trying to organize it. He didn't see that there was one set thing called a genus species. So that was kind of imposed on biology from Linnaeus. And so one of the interesting questions here is, and played a very central role, especially by the 19th century, is, well, what is a species? What is a biological species? Now, before Darwin, there were a number of people who had proposed an evolutionary sort of scheme. But most all biologists and non-biologists, their view of species was that God had independently created each one of them where they were found. So God independently created each species and put them in their current location. That was the perspective of biologists at the time Darwin wrote. So, what is a species? Well, that's not an easy question to answer exactly. And no one really sort of answered that exactly. You have taxonomists who are classifying all this stuff, and then some people point out, well, this guy over here is a lumper and this guy's a splitter, and, you know, what exactly is a species? Well, no one actually really nailed that down very well. But that makes a great deal of difference when we get to Darwin, and we'll see in just a minute why. Because underneath species, there were varieties. And no one in the 19th century denied there were varieties. I mean, and we know, well, there were different varieties of dogs. There were different varieties of pigeons. There were different varieties of chickens. So everybody knew that there were all kinds of varieties, and no one denied that varieties originated from species, and they all differed by degree. So what's the difference between a variety and a species? Well, that was an important issue that actually wasn't being addressed very carefully. But Darwin comes along, and he sort of pulled a card trick. He pulled an ace out of his sleeve and never told anybody sort of about that. What he did was, see, for virtually all biologists, species meant kind, meaning they were all different from each other and there was an unbridgeable gulf between them. That's what we meant by species. That's what they meant by species. Well, Darwin starts out talking about species sort of just like them, but he does two things. One, in their perspective, which goes back to Aristotle, when we want to think about a great blue heron, we have some type specimen. We have some ideal specimen of a great blue heron sitting in some museum. And so what we're asking is, how does this bird, which looks like a heron, is this a great blue heron? So we're always looking for those common features. What Darwin pointed out is not looking at common features, but he's going to look at their differences. And the second thing he does is he says, well, look, no one denies there's varieties. Well, when I look at pigeons, I mean, we see a bazillion different kinds of pigeons. And I don't know if you've ever seen pigeons, but there's some kind of pigeons. Anybody here know much about pigeons? But there's some of them that can't even fly anymore and some of them that don't even walk. They've been bred to such a point that they can't fly, they can barely walk. I mean, they don't look like pigeons. And there's all these varieties of pigeons. And he said, well, who would look at this incredible diversity? And we all know those are variations. Well, but we're calling species stuff out here that varies by this much. I mean, what sense does that make? And then he goes on to argue that actually species are arbitrarily defined. And that there is no, they aren't kinds at all. This was the card trick, that they just differ by degree, just like varieties. What a species is just more diversity. Once diversity gets so big in varieties, we're now going to call it species. Because that's convenient. And that's how it works. So he sort of turned the classification system on its head. Do you follow what I'm saying? So that was one thing he did. The other thing I'll point out is that with regard to the issue that he says in the preface is what he's writing his book about, and that is he disagrees with those who say that species are independent creations of God. He's showing instances where, in fact, he's showing that one species changes into another species. Now, does that happen? Sure. Happens all the time. Actually, I changed my mind. I do want to go to the board for just a minute. Let's see if I got enough cord. See if my chain will reach. Okay. So, for example, take the United States, and there's a number of species we can do this for, but I'll just pick a common one that should be known to everybody. The common tree common frog, it's called Rana pipiens. It's found all the way across the United States. If you divide the United States into 9 zones, like time zones, okay? And you take a Rana pipiens, this frog from here, and interbreed it with a frog from here, and then do this all the way across. Each one of these frogs will interbreed with each other if you do it that way. Okay? But if you take one from A, and you take one from wherever we are, G or wherever we are over here, they can no longer interbreed. And there's a whole bunch of organisms that show the same thing. So, does this suggest that varieties are becoming isolated into separate species? Well, this is the kind of evidence that Darwin and virtually all biologists are bringing and saying, yeah, that looks like there's a new species forming there. Are they right about that? Yes, that is what's going on. So, the issue is here, given our classification system that we accept, would we say that there are species, that a new species is being developed here? Yes. Now, but let me point out that there's several more questions here that are really important. This hasn't proven Darwin's whole case. He's just shown that you can get a new species from a pre-existing species. Does that mean he's proven the whole thing? No. He just showed that the biologists of his day were actually wrong about the origin of new species. It is true that new species can arise out of pre-existing species. Okay, is that important? Is that an important observation? Yeah. But as I say, does that prove Darwin's theory is correct? Darwin argued yes. But that argument depends on several philosophical assumptions that he never stated and that no one's really identified to my knowledge, yet no one's ever clearly identified them. All of them in the same place. And I'm going to talk about those in a few minutes. But what Darwin did was basically take this kind of information, which had been collected by people all over the world for plants, all kinds of animals, insects. They all found the same sort of thing. And so, does this happen? And I would say yes. They're correct that that happens. So that this is a piece of what does have to be explained. But as I say, that result doesn't end up, that result alone doesn't basically, you don't end up with Darwin's theory, if that's what you accept. Unless you're willing to buy three or four unstated philosophical assumptions. And we'll talk about those later. So that's the background I sort of wanted to give. Now let me turn to the interaction between science and intelligent design. Well, I'll stop. Are there questions? I may deflect them for a little while, but you can try. You can try. If there are questions you want to take on, yes.
What's kind of interesting about this is you go A, B, and then breathe, and you continue on, then the ancestors of A are going to be able to breathe G.
The ancestors, yes, previous ancestors probably would have. Yes, that's correct. But what you are seeing is a group of organisms becoming reproductively isolated.
I mean, when you were pointing that out, I don't believe that. You can get, if you go across there, ancestors of A that can breathe G.
That's right. But that's Darwin's point. Yeah. Okay, anything else? Okay. All right, now let's look at the interaction for just a minute between science and intelligent design. First, I'll talk about the strategy from the perspective of the proponents of intelligent design. And I haven't seen explicitly written what their strategy was. So I'm doing this by looking at what was going on and sort of trying to reconstruct what I think the strategy is. So I may be wrong, but this is what it looks like to me. It looks like the perspective that they have is what they really want to have is they want to have a dialogue in the scientific arena with regard to the credibility, if you will, or the respectability or the reliability or the maybe even the truthfulness of intelligent design within the scientific arena. That's what they want. It seems to me the strategy from the perspective of the proponents of Darwin's theory, they sort of have two perspectives. One is, don't say anything about it. Because if we don't talk about it, then it ain't science. So that takes care of that. The second sort of strategy is, well, they will critique, make explicit critiques of certain parts of it. Like they critiqued Behe's idea of the irreducibly complex structure. And they point out that there are certain problems with what he had proposed. He hadn't considered that some of these building blocks might have been used for other things inside that organism, and then those building blocks shifted functions. So this indirect shifting of functions within an organism so that things built for one function over time can actually shift into and have another function. That he hadn't considered that. And most of the microbiologists and biochemists are arguing that they have a number of those almost worked out of things where they've shifted functions. So they've almost got those worked out, not quite. But anyway, their argument is Behe didn't really consider that. And I mean, he's a microbiologist and a biochemist with biochemistry background. He should have figured that out. He should have realized that that's the case. And that at least requires that he back off his stronger statement about, because they just look like they're irreducible, that by this indirect means you can actually get reducibility, or they can be built. They can be built by this shift of function. Now they look like they're irreducible, but they're actually not. Okay, so just it seems to me that those are the strategies of the two sides. And just a punchline of where I want to go next week, probably. I don't think I'll get to it much of it today. But what I want to argue is I think both of those positions are actually fallacious. That both perspectives have made fundamental errors that are really a major impediment to our ever having any dialogue about this issue. What I'm going to argue is this. The assumption that's made is this is a scientific question. It's going to be decided based on facts. And it's a discussion that the majority of people involved in it should be scientists. I think that is false. All of that is false. That's all I want to say about that right now. But that's the critique I'm going to get to next time, is I think the problem here is the fundamental problem that is making this impossible to get intelligent discourse on these kind of issues is, number one, how we view science. How do we do science? Number two is, what is the role of a scientist in these debates? And I'm going to argue that it's pretty darn small, that these are fundamentally not scientific questions. It's not an issue of facts. So that's where I'm going to go next time, largely. I may begin to touch on a little bit of it at the end of this time, but we'll see if I get there. I'll stop again. Questions or things you want to dialogue with right now? Yes?
Can you repeat what the second reason was why it's like impossible to have intelligence? These are the first and most important.
Our view of science. The second is the role of science in the debate. Yeah. Okay. Now I want to talk about the Dover court case, the Kitzmiller versus the Dover Area School District. As I unpack this court case, like I say, my reaction to this was, I was just appalled that anyone could look at that and look at it as a logical, rational position of any kind. It just isn't. So what I'd like to do for a while, for maybe about 20 minutes or so, is to go through in a little bit of detail the judge's ruling and part of it. I don't know how much background you have about reading, court cases and all of this, but the judge's ruling in this case was 170 pages. That's fairly long. And there was a lot of testimony here. Now part of this, I do want to say, in part it's a problem with the judge and his thinking and his decisions. But if that's all it was, I probably wouldn't have reacted the way I did, nor responded the way I did. My problem is that the defense attorneys never brought up fundamental issues that this whole thing turns on. They just let the other guys run over them. So, for example, yes?
Are you going to just state exactly what the court case was about?
Yes. Yeah, I'll just make one more statement, then I'll come back to that. So I do want to say that if it was just the judge and just the fact that this was the logic of this particular judge making the ruling, I wouldn't have reacted the way I did. But it was attorneys on both sides. It was, you know, basically the media and everybody's response to it. There was this just common response for the most part. And it went on both sides in the sense of the major, what I thought were the major issues that were just outrageous to me, neither side pointed any of them out. That was the outrageous part to me. Now, what was this court case about? The Dover, it's Pennsylvania area school system, was, they had introduced into their biology curriculum teaching intelligent design. A number of the students' parents basically sued the school district over that. And the issue was that was imposing religion on the biology department. Now, let's see. I think I even have the ruling as, I think I have his wording right here. No, I don't. I don't have enough of it. Well, anyway, basically the judge ruled that intelligent design could not be taught as biology. And the issue, again, was it was teaching religion in biology class. So that this was an issue of separation of church and state is the way that he answered what the court... Ultimately, that's how he ruled. Okay. The specific part I want to interact with in a bit of detail is sort of what I think is one of the core issues here, and that is, well, a major part of this court case was raising the issue of what is science and how do we decide what is science and what is not science. And what was said was very interesting. And as I say, here I'm going to get into a little detail for a few minutes, but bear with me. You know, maybe this is just when I have to arm wave and do whatever, but there are just some details here that are just incredible to me. So what the judge said was, ID is not science because it fails on three levels, and any one of these three would be sufficient to preclude that ID is science. The first one is, intelligent design violates the centuries-old ground rules of science by invoking and permitting supernatural causation. Okay? That's number one. Number two.
Say that one again.
Okay. Intelligent design violates the centuries-old ground rules of science by invoking and permitting supernatural causation. And I'll talk in detail about it. Probably more detail than you want, but it's... but, okay, the second one is, the argument of irreducible complexity central to intelligent design employs the same flawed and illogically contrived dualism that doomed creation science in the 80s. So he's basically saying It makes the same mistakes that creation science, it does the same thing that creation science did in the 80s, which the Supreme Court ruled was not science back in the 80s. And then intelligent design's negative attack on evolution has been refuted by the scientific community. Okay? Now,
well, we need to come back tomorrow.
So those are the three grounds upon which the judge ruled that intelligent design was not science. Now what I'd like to do is I'd like to look at those one at a time. So the first one is that it violates the centuries-old ground rules of science. Okay, and there was a lot of expert testimony here by some of the leading PhDs in philosophy of science arguing that for 500 years, science has been defined as testing hypotheses. Now, I find that interesting because testing hypotheses is the language of Karl Popper in the 1930s. So this isn't 400 or 500 years. This is Karl Popper talking from the 1930s. So this is maybe 50 years of how science was sort of defined. But my problem is that, and I know I'm getting old here, but even in my lifetime, I've seen changes in what's considered acceptable science and not science. I mean, I've seen changes in my lifetime. One of those was Thomas Kuhn's book, Structure of Scientific Revolutions. That was a whole different way of looking at what science is and how it's done. Well, Kuhn's book was written in the late 1950s. So my first question is, well, what is this centuries-old ground rules of science? So because I went back and it seems to me science, the origin of modern science, is the Copernican Revolution. What hypothesis did the Copernicans test? Did Copernicus test any? Galileo? Newton? None of those guys tested anything. So you're telling me by that definition none of those guys are scientists. Because they didn't test any theories. They were just writing them. They were discovering and writing theories. So my problem right out of the box here is, what are these ground rules that are 500 years old? As somebody who's worked in science for a while, I don't know what they are. I mean, what method is in and what method's out? So I don't know where that came from. And it came from the leading PhDs in the country in philosophy of science who have written books basically pointing out this evolution over the last 400 or 500 years. So why they'll get up and testify that this is 500 years old, I'm not sure why. But they nonetheless got up and testified that the rules of science have been set for centuries. I don't know what they are. I've never seen them in print. So my first problem is, I have no idea what these rules of science are. And it sure isn't testing hypotheses and writing journal articles, because that's Karl Popper's theory of science that originated in the 1930s, which is by and large the accepted view of science today by the people that are involved in biology here. What is science? Journal articles. Research in journal articles. That's science today. Well, but that isn't 500 years old. So my first problem is, I have no idea what any of this is. I don't even have any idea what they would claim these ground rules are. And then the second part, by invoking or permitting supernatural causation. Well, why do they say this? Well, science is defined these days by what you can measure. If you can't measure it, it's not science. Because if you can't measure it and do your experiments and run your statistics, it's not science. So invoking supernatural causation, you can't measure it. Now, that wouldn't necessarily rule that out. I mean, you also have Newton, who claimed, well, we couldn't directly measure gravity either, directly. But indirectly, he could measure its effects. So, anyway, there is an issue here of how far you're going to allow indirect measurement. But, nonetheless, if you're going to define science as measurement and test and hypotheses, then obviously supernatural causation has to be outside the box. At least as it's understood now. I mean, there is a way you could formulate it and make it work, but that isn't the formulation we've got. Okay. The second one I don't really want to talk much about. The idea of the dualism, that the idea was that any refutation, any problem that you could point to in Darwin's theory would be positive evidence for creation science. That was the perspective that past court cases had thrown out. That just because you refuted Darwin's theory or there's a problem with Darwin's theory, that's not necessarily support for a theist or a creationist perspective. Could be something else. I mean, could just be some other theory. Now, and so the argument was, in the 80s it was being made that a particular critique of evolutionary theory would be support of a creationist theory. And so anyway, several court cases ruled that wasn't true. And I mean, I haven't looked at the details of whether or not in the particular instance I think they were right about that or not, I don't know. So with the issues that were raised, I don't know if they were right about that or not. So, but anyway, the last one was that ID's negative attack on evolution has been refuted by the scientific community. Well, giving that as an explanation, as grounds for denying that something is science, it's just absolutely crazy to me. But let's back up and look at the logic, because the logic is accepted by virtually everyone who works in the scientific field. I was in that boat, and as I say, it was those two books that ripped this in part out from under me. The first one is, the first point I want to make is that, well, let me go back in history and talk about this situation in the Copernican Revolution because it plays a central role. So Copernicus writes his theory, and it doesn't go really anywhere. There's not much interest in it. And so for 50, 60 years, the church basically didn't pay any attention to it, and neither did anybody else except for a few mathematicians. But then comes Galileo. And now it's an issue. And one of the things that happens here is there's an interesting interchange between Galileo and the church. And I want to read that. If I can find it. It's pretty bad when you can't find it in your own book. I was going to put a place marker in it, and I didn't get it, so okay. It's going to be in this chapter. Here we go. Okay, here's what it's about. Now, it's about a page long, so bear with me, but it's a great quote. So here's the setup for this. So the church is coming along and arguing, well, Galileo, we have a problem. And the problem is, look, it's been 60 years that this Copernican theory has been out here. And it hasn't attracted any attention. It's gotten like no supporters. So don't you think that if it was right, that the science, that the community of peers here would be convinced that it's right? Okay? So the fact that it's attracted very little attention and it's gotten very few, if any, advocates, they're arguing that's evidence it must not be a very good theory. Okay? Here's his reply, and the guy who wrote this was Sarcey. That's his name. Perhaps Sarcey believes that all the host of good philosophers may be enclosed within four walls. I believe that they fly, and they fly alone, like eagles, and not in flocks like starlings. It's true, because eagles are rare birds, that they are little seen and less heard, while birds that fly like starling fill the sky with shrieks and cries, and wherever they settle, they befoul the earth underneath them. Yet if true philosophers are like eagles, they are not unique like the phoenix. The crowd of fools who know nothing, Sarcey, is infinite. Those who know a little philosophy, and when he uses philosophy here, he's talking about natural philosophy or science. So wherever you see science or philosophy, think science. Those who know very little philosophy are numerous. Few indeed are they who really know some part of it, and only one knows all. To put aside hints and speak plainly and deal with science as a method of demonstration and reasoning capable of human pursuit, I hold that the more this partakes of perfection, the smaller number of propositions it will promise to teach, and the fewer yet it will conclusively prove. Consequently, the more perfect it is, the less attractive it will be, and the fewer its followers. On the other hand, magnificent titles and many grandiose promises attract the natural curiosity of men and hold them forever involved in fallacies and chimeras without ever offering them up a single sample of that sharpness of true proof by which the taste may be awakened to know how insipid is the ordinary fare of philosophy. Such things will keep an infinite number of men occupied, and that man will indeed be fortunate who, led by some inner light, can turn from the dark and confused labyrinth in which he might have gone perpetually winding with the crowd and becoming ever more tangled. Hence, I consider it not very sound judgment. Hence, I consider it not very sound to judge a man's philosophical opinions by the number of his followers. Yet, though I believe the number of disciples of the best philosophy may be quite small, I don't conclude conversely that those opinions and doctrines are necessarily perfect from which have few followers. For I know well enough that some men hold opinions so erroneous as to be rejected by virtually everybody else. But from which of those sources the two authors mentioned by Sarcey derived the scarcity of their followers, I don't know, for I have not studied their work sufficiently to judge. So what's his point? His point here is, and what I find interesting is, the issue is, where's the authority of science lie? They're arguing with the peers. Galileo is arguing it always rests with the reason of the individual scientist. I mean, Galileo is what? Within a century of Luther. I mean, you can see both of them with the same sort of method and mindset about what is authoritative. What's authoritative? It's what my own reason tells me is true. Now, what I find interesting is one of the major marks that people point to in the history of ideas here from the Middle Ages to the modern period is the move in authority. It moved from the church authority to the individual scientist, and that's a mark, one of the marks of the modern period. where it looks like to me in the 20th century we've reverted back to the medieval model. So in essence, what we've done is change one priesthood for another. So anyway, so one of my comments with regards to the idea that it's been refuted by in the scientific community is simply, well, that's a reversion to the medieval model. The second one is if you look at the criticisms that have been labeled at, well, so for example, with regard to the irreversible complexity issue, well, the refutation takes this form, and that is, it's plausible that these structures originally served this purpose and now have evolved and are now fulfilling this. Now, we'll admit we haven't exactly proven that yet, but it's certainly plausible. So that's considered a refutation. That possibility suggests a refutation. So we just don't know. We haven't nailed those details down yet, but we think it's perfectly plausible that that kind of thing has happened. Now, the second part of this is that intelligent design hasn't been able, well, there aren't a number of peer-reviewed journal articles supporting intelligent design. Well, it seems to me that's a self-fulfilling prophecy, and I don't have to say much more about that. It's not too difficult for the scientific, well, in fact, many of you probably know what happened to the editor of a journal who allowed a paper to get published that at least raised the issue of intelligent design. He was fired. So the bottom line is the whole grounds upon which the last criteria were put together make little or no sense to me. So at least with regard to his evidence, we have the three then. And he said any one of these three would be enough, basically, to any one of these three would be enough to show intelligent design is not science. So the first one was it violated the centuries-old ground rules of science by invoking and permitting supernatural causes. The second one was the illogically contrived dualism. Evidence against evolution is necessarily evidence for creationism. And then the third one was the negative attacks of ID on evolution have been refuted by the scientific community. So those are the grounds upon which the judge ruled intelligent design was not science. So I'd like to just end with one thing as far as what I was going to say tonight, and then just throw it open for questions. But just an observation. It seems to me that if you're going to argue Darwin's theory is science, it seems to me you have to acknowledge that intelligent design is science on the same grounds. Here's why. They're just the flip side of the same coin. On one side of this coin is basically an argument that would say, the natural variations that we see are the result of chance and natural selection. And if then a theory that argues that the biological diversity we see is the result of chance and natural selection, if we're going to call that science, then it would seem to me that a theory that says it's not the result of chance and natural selection, but rather intelligent design, how could you deny that was science on the same grounds? I mean, it's the same question. The only issue is, it's the same question of what is the cause. And it's either random and uncaused, or it's caused. On what grounds are you saying one is science and the other isn't science? Now, again, coming back to where we started, see, what I would argue is these are all philosophical issues. They're not scientific issues that are really at stake. And so, as I say, I'll come back next time and try to flesh out here why I think these questions are actually philosophical and not scientific. So one of the things I'll do next time is come back and actually go through Darwin's central argument. And I'll, anyway, we'll start and go through his central argument, and I'll use that as one of my starting places. So anyway, I'll stop. And with regard to anything, questions or where you want to go for the time we've got left?
When you were talking about the debate between the church, mm-hmm. what you brought up immediately came to mind. But also, see, I've done some study on the nutrition, and the homeopathic doctors started an association, mm-hmm. and the association for doctors.
Oh, okay.
DMA, thank you, was started to refute the homeopathic doctors. And so they started their own peer review journals, mm-hmm. and you get some of the same thing that mm-hmm. they were doing that the Darwinians and evolutionists mm-hmm. are doing today. Mm-hmm. And this is a bone of contention with my father. My mm-hmm. father is a retired biologist. Mm-hmm. And every once in a while we'll bump heads. And his central argument is he'll bring one of these peer-reviewed journals and say, boom, here, this is a peer-reviewed journal refuting what you say. And mm-hmm. I can't get beyond mm-hmm. that because it is a peer-reviewed
right.
journal.
Yeah, and, well, in part, just to comment on mm-hmm. and your comment is that's in large part been a central part of my struggle I'll talk about this next week, but is one of the books I mentioned was Michael Polanyi, and he was a theoretical chemist and a very well-known theoretical chemist. Well, he basically wrote part of a book in several articles arguing that biology couldn't be reduced to chemistry and physics. Now, this was back in the 1960s or 70s. Well, what was interesting is he was dangerous because he wasn't a Christian, he was a naturalist. And so they actually got Francis Crick to write a rebuttal. But his rebuttal is basically one paragraph. And he basically just says, Polanyi has gotten notice by the literary circles, but he's not doing science. And that's basically all it said, and that was the end of that. Mm-hmm. Well, if you got a naturalist who's an internationally renowned chemist, you know, arguing about life, whether or not it can be reduced to chemistry and physics, and the materialistic atomist theory of Crick and Watson is at stake, well, they'll just say it isn't science because we do science. That's the move. You don't ever have to really address the issues. You just bully them.
Yeah, and bringing up philosophical, I'm beginning to understand more what you mean by philosophical, because I'm thinking, you know, the arguments that when Luther was under trial, mm-hmm. I mean, there was no reasoning on the side of the Catholic Church. It's just that you're in danger. You're coming against the Catholic Church.
Yeah, I don't know all the details there, but
it was basically, you know, this article. Yeah. I mean, the people that were, you know, putting Luther on trial, the only defense they had was their tradition mm-hmm. and were the church.
Yeah, well, but as I say, I see the major problem here is an error that's made both by the ID folks and the proponents on the other side, is both of them have accepted a view of science that is just not defensible. And as long as that's the arena the debate's in, it's over. Yes?
You mentioned atomists when you were talking about Aristotle and just now, and pardon my ignorance, but what is that?
Okay.
What does that mean?
Well, an atomist is basically someone who believes that the basic unit or the fundamental real thing in the universe are atoms. And so things like human beings are just a composite of various atoms. So there's a number of views that can be taken with regard to atomism, but the one that's accepted most widely today, because it came back in from Francis Crick and others, is this notion. The question is, can biology be reduced to chemistry and physics? Okay. The real question is here, is life any different than what happens to a rock? The point is, no. So the point is, whatever natural chemistry and physics tell us how things work, they tell us how things work in life as well as non-living stuff. It's all the same. So the issue for the atomists here then is, see, all explanation of human psychology, all of this, our brains, all of that is just the result of matter and energy moving. In other words, matter and energy moving is the cause of everything, even your choices. Okay? So that's a strict atomist view here. That is the view that's accepted by most biologists, anyone who would trace their heritage back to Crick and Watson, because that is their perspective.
Yeah, I've heard that perspective, but I didn't know it was called that, and I didn't know it was from before Aristotle.
Oh, yeah. That's interesting. It's been around for a very long time. Yeah. Yeah, any other questions? Yes?
Just going back to your start about trying to define intelligent design. Mm-hmm. You gave the two examples, but what is the definition? What definition would you be working with?
Let me see. Let me see if I wrote one down that I liked or if I've got to think about this a little bit. Well, basically, intelligent design is a theory that says there are certain features in nature, like these irreducible complex structures, or like these appearance of intelligence that Dembski points to, that can't be accounted for by Darwinian causes. Therefore, they must be caused by an intelligent agent, because they can't be the result of chance plus natural selection. Will that suffice?
Mm-hmm.
I guess my question is whether it's biology or chemistry or philosophy, when we introduce spirituality into that complexity thing, doesn't that what changes for all of us, though? I mean, you think a certain way in life, and then all of a sudden you've introduced spirituality or a deeper spirituality in your own life, and it changes quite a bit.
Well, it changes a lot. Well, a couple comments first. Well, first, as somebody who's a biologist, one of my observations about this issue is it actually saddens me a lot that this whole debate has little or nothing to do with about biology. I mean, nobody'd get excited about a biological theory. I mean, nobody's excited about the biological theory. It's all about, I mean, that's what this is about. It's not about biology, because 99.9% of the people that are most, you know, passionate about this, they could care less about anything in biology. So, yes, it is all about much larger issues. Now, just a caution. I mean, it strikes me that it's perfectly plausible. Now, I'm not saying I believe this, but I think it's perfectly plausible that it might be the case that God used Darwinian evolution to basically give us most of the biology we see. Is that possible? Well, that's possible. So even if Darwin's theory of evolution turned out to be true, and I mean, given what I've said, I think you know that I don't believe it's true, but even if it was, it seems to me that could be made perfectly compatible with theistic Christianity. It's not, you know, logically it doesn't necessitate that difference. And, I mean, I think that's a central part of the reason that it's a problem, is that, you know, lines have been drawn in the sand that really, I think, those aren't the lines that should have been drawn. Those aren't the places necessarily they should have been drawn, or for those particular reasons. So, anyway, all I'm saying is, you know, it seems to me it's logically possible someone could be a biblical-believing Christian and be a Darwinian evolutionist at the same time. It seems to me that as theories, now, the other part is where's the limits on Darwin's theory? I mean, that's what I'm going to talk about the fallacy when we come. What did Darwin actually say? And, I mean, I think it shocks most people, including biologists, because I'm not sure any of them have ever read Darwin. But Darwin's theory is not a universal theory about the origin of life. It's not that. It's explicitly not that. So his theory doesn't have, it's not out there at that limit. It has more narrowly defined limits to start with.
Since spirituality, introducing your own personal spirituality and those beliefs, have a lot of religions muddled this, because they all have, you know, they usually kind of have their own perspective.
Well, it's a little hard for me. To be honest, I'm not sure. I mean, I would say for a number of individuals, that's true. But there's a lot of individuals, I don't know what their motivation or their thinking really is. I mean, it's clear to me a lot of people think that if Darwinian evolution's true, then that's the end of God. Now, I mean, there's a number of people, I'm sure, that that's their perspective on this, and that's why they react so strongly. If that was true, I'd be very sympathetic with that. But as I say, as I look at it, and when I look at what Darwin's theory actually says, and the limits that Darwin himself put on his theory, it seems to me that those two things aren't necessarily mutually exclusive. Now, as I say, I'll come back next week and give you a critique of Darwin's theory. But anyway, is that answering your question?
I think that I overheard someone who was being critical of Behe mention that they thought this was just, he'd sort of set up a straw man anyway, because people who believe in evolution today aren't even particularly attached to Darwinian evolution. I don't know anything about that. What are current evolutionists actually stating, and is that substantially different from Darwin?
Well, there are a number of different theories of evolution than Darwin's. Probably the person you might be familiar with, well, he died a few years back, but Stephen Jay Gould. Stephen Jay Gould was not actually a Darwinian evolutionist, meaning that, well, I'm going to have to hold part of that question off because part of it is about what philosophical assumptions he would make that are different than Darwin's.
Okay, so, yeah, that's fine. Maybe this is better addressed next week.
Yeah, okay. But I'll say one of them is a Marxist kind of philosophy with regard to this. So a Marxist philosophy of nature, and that's at least part of the time it looks to me as if that was where Stephen Jay Gould was headed. So anyone, well, remember, well, and then the other piece of this is how anal you want to be about defining Darwin's theory. And the reason I say that is Darwin didn't have a theory of heredity that worked. The theory of heredity he believed in was blending. Well, the problem with blending is that if all reproduction is random, everything's going to go to the middle. You can't maintain diversity. So how do you maintain diversity if you're going to hold a theory of heredity that accepts blending? Well, in the I think there's 18 additions to Darwin's work, and I think in 14 of them he changed his position with regards to heredity. Some of them he accepted Lamarck's theory of use and disuse. So part of this is what exactly, this is part of the problem, and this is what we're going to point out next time, is when we're talking about Darwin's theory of evolution, evolution is a word that's used many different ways, and there's equivocation all the time about what this word is. Well, next time, that's going to be part of what we do. We're going to look at evolution and where people are equivocating back and forth. We're also going to look at the limits of Darwin's theory and the philosophical assumptions. So there are a number of different philosophical assumptions that are held. So there's a lot of biologists who, I would say, I don't know what percent, because I work in ecology, and 90% of biologists now are biochemists and geneticists that I can't even talk to. So I can't say what portion, but there are a number of different theories that are actually not Darwinian. So a lot of biologists do not hold Darwin's theory. And Dawkins is taking him to task on that, and many of them will actually respond that they really don't appreciate the kind of help Dawkins is giving, because he is a Darwinian evolutionist. So, anything else? I've kept you over, it looks like. But any other question before next week? Okay, well, thanks.